Welcome to Breadline from the Australian Unemployed Workers Union on Community Radio 3CR.
So put down that job plan and listen to us.
I'd first like to acknowledge that this program is being broadcast from the lands of the Wurundjeri of the Kulin Nation. So their sovereignty was never ceded, and we want to pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. And we also acknowledge that the unfairness of the welfare system disproportionately affects First Nations people.
Hello, it's 4:30 and you are listening to a special hour-long episode of Breadline here on 3CR 8:55 AM on your dial or online at 3cr.org.au. My name is Caitlin Blythe. I'm not the usual host of Breadline. You might have heard me on last night spruiking this show. It's Disability Day, the best day of the year, Disabled Christmas. And I just love 3CR's day-long broadcast for Disability Day. And the theme, of course, is Embodied Solidarities. So Breadline is the AUWU, the Australian Union of... Wait, hang on. The Australian Unemployed Workers Union's show. Of course, we support people who are on welfare payments and out of work. And that, of course, affects disabled people disproportionately. So today we're doing a big deep dive on the DSP, the history of disability and welfare in Australia, so-called Australia. And I've got a couple of really cool interviews lined up for you, as well as some tunes. Let's go to one now. So you are listening to Breadline on 3CR. My name's Caitlin, and this is Teen Jesus and the Gene Teasers with Used to Be Fun.
Hi, this is Jessica.
And this is Daryl.
And we're from Breadline.
Breadline.
And we love listening to 3CR because...
We're on it.
No, because it's a community station.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Giving the voiceless a voice.
Voice. You're listening to 3CR's Disability Day broadcast, theme embodied solidarities. And of course, at Breadline, we know all about the importance of solidarity. My name is Caitlin Blythe. I'm your special guest host today. They brought in a disabled person for the special hour-long episode, so that's what we're doing. And I've got a pre-recorded interview coming up for you with Nix, who is an AUWU member, activist and organizer. And I just want to say that just to frame this interview, Nix had just been telling me about the Accords, which was something that was like an agreement between the ACTU and the Labour Party that happened, I believe, in the 90s, late 80s, and how that sort of changed the shape of it. Sort of gave us Medicare and superannuation, but it also sort of, you know, as Nix was telling me, undercut the maybe abilities to strike in Australia. So anyway, but then we got on to a really interesting chat about what it's like to be disabled in the union movement. So here is Nix on Breadline.
I would love to get your perspective, because you have so much experience in the union space, of what it's like being... So for me, I have found I've just sort of dipped my toe into union organizing, and it's really difficult as a person who is not a worker, say, in a classic sense. Like, I'm always sort of asking, what's the place in collective organizing for people who can't work and who shouldn't work? It's all structured around, I think a lot of the inspirations and structures come from trade unions. It's about workers and, you know, collective bargaining against a boss. And that's great. Obviously, we need that. But what about the people who don't have a boss, who can't work, who can't show up to all the meetings, who can't, you know, be on the front lines, so to speak?
Well, there is a few things that we can do that are at least proven to be effective, even though we can't, you know, we can't strike, right? But for instance, something that I'm pretty sure the AWU has done before, but is there's much more of a precedent for this in the UK, is targeted campaigns against all of the NGOs and companies that are using work for the dole label, right? So every time that there's a job site where people are being not paid for their work, essentially, that, you know, like a picketing campaign that basically it's just meant to publicly embarrass, you know, whoever's behind it until they drop it. Now we can do that. We also have the ability to technically, if we actually got organized enough, if everyone in a job service provider transferred to another job service provider at the same time, that's the equivalent of going on strike. They don't get their money. Right?
Right. What's the mechanism there? Why don't they get their money?
Because they're paid per client. Right? There's boxes that they tick, and when they tick those boxes, they get a commission from the government. So if all of their clients transferred away at the same time, that completely kills the income stream of that particular job service provider. Which is quite localized, but would be effective collective action, right?
Right. Does that money not just go to the JSP that they've transferred to?
It would, but we would essentially be able to take advantage of the fact that because it's a privatized system, they're in competition with each other.
Making neoliberalist capitalism work for us.
Yeah, essentially, you know, so we would be able to use it as a threat against any job service provider that goes too far, is that, you know, everyone will just shut down that particular site and go to another company and use their own competition against them. Before COVID-19, in the Melbourne branch of the AWU, we were talking about, we were trying to organize. COVID-19 hit, everything kind of fell apart. And branch meetings sort of only recently started up again in the CBD. Other things that we can do is, and I mean, I've genuinely yet to see this happen within the AWU, and I would love to work towards it. But we may not have the same economic power as fully employed people, but whenever workers are taking industrial action, say for instance, recently in the NTU, I heard about an instance in, I think it was UniMelb, in which suspiciously a whole bunch of women of color were getting, you know, made redundant at the same time, right?
Right.
And redundancy is, that's job loss, it's unemployment. That's something that affects all workers. We should be turning up to those pickets.
Right.
Because when we extend a hand and we extend solidarity, then that changes those people who realize that they have something in common with us. Because everything that we want to sort of fight and achieve, whether that is just a much more fair welfare system with better, you know, payments, bringing back the Commonwealth Employment Service so we don't have a for-profit punishing system that is managing us. All of these demands would happen in an instant if the union movement actually took them up and challenged the Labour Party, right?
What's stopping the union movement from having solidarity with disabled and unemployed people, though?
I think it is entirely just that since the Accords Act was passed, the union movement, it's not very active, right? There's a lot more members on paper than there are on the ground at, you know, branch meetings and worksite meetings and such. And ultimately, the union movement, the average, you know, the average person who signs up to a union rather than the leadership, I think people have just gotten used to the system. Because, you know, previously in the past, all forms of welfare and healthcare, unions had to fight for them because there wasn't something that was a government service provided to people, right? But now that that is there, the average union member thinks that there's a system there that's going to take care of them. They just don't realize, right? And I mean, ultimately, I haven't really seen much, and look, there's probably a lot more out there than I've encountered, but I have not seen much in the way of disability activism that is actually going hand in hand with the union movement in my lifetime, right? Like, I've seen a lot of disability activism, but not that solidarity being extended actively.
So it's up to disabled people to extend solidarity to unions?
It's a two-way street. You know, I don't think that, I think it is. I think that, like, ultimately, there are things that we can do without needing to rely on employed people's sort of economic power. And we should do them. But I believe that it's not just disability. I mean, unemployment, retirement, you know, job loss, underemployment, you know, the instances of people having one shift every 2 weeks on a casual job, right? These conditions, like, this affects everyone, everyone's work conditions, as you know. And I mean, the fact that the JSP system is creating that casualization means that it is in the interests of all workers to stand up for us and vice versa, right? Solidarity is strength.
Sure, but what about someone who can't work and never will work?
I mean, I'm in that position. I still go to union demos, right?
That's great that you can
Because
do that,
ultimately,
but
yeah,
we have
not
to
everyone can. I know that.
have solidarity with the most vulnerable people, like, people who are completely bedbound, who can't, feed themselves, speak. Where do they fit in, the idea that they have to reach out to the unions first and have solidarity with the unions for the unions to realize that we are all connected. The power dynamic is unequal.
It is unequal. It's unfair. I don't, and to me, I don't think that this is really that possible if we are just working as lone activists,
I don't think
right?
anyone's suggesting that we all work as lone activists, but what is the this? What do you want to see, I guess, happen? What would you love to see happen here in so-called Australia?
I would like to see unemployed and disabled people going to pickets, going to union demonstrations, setting up our own pickets and demonstrations, making friends with rank and file workers in, say, the CPSU, so that when we go and start our own protests, they turn up and they join us.
Will they be wearing masks? Will they be taking COVID precautions? Will they make it accessible?
We have to be a part of organ if we don't organize it, it'll never happen, right? If we don't like actually, make contact with that movement, it won't happen. And I mean, we can still do our activism. We can still, without the unions, but our power is always going to be quite minimal.
Well, this has been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much, Nix. I really appreciate your time and energy. So, thank you
Cheers.
for being here on the Breadline Disability Day special.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to three times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Breadline on 3CR. It's the special hour-long episode for Disability Day. It's the Disability Day broadcast with the theme Embodied Solidarities. And just before you heard my interview with Nix, activist and organizer from the Australian Unemployed Workers Union, or AWU. Later on, I'm going to play an interview with a historian about the history of the visibility of disabled people in Australia. My name is Caitlin Blythe. I'm guest hosting Breadline just for this special episode today. We're going to be hearing from your regular beloved host, co-host Jessica Harrison later. But now I think we should go to a song. And this is Amyl and the Sniffers with Guided by Angels. And I'm pretty sure we need a language warning on this one. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Heavenly, they're on my body and they guide me. Heavenly.
Legendary What Is Music organiser Robbie Avanane presents the second annual Safe In Sound Festival. This event, taking place from December 6th to the 8th at Jolted Sonic Arts in Northcote, will highlight experimental music and feature performances from both established musicians and creators with disabilities. The festival aims to revitalise the Australian avant-garde and challenge the boundaries of free music. For more details on the festival, go to safeinsound.com.au. Safe In Sound Festival is a 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to Breadline on 3CR. My name's Caitlin Blythe, and just before that community advert, you heard Amyl and the Sniffers with Guided by Angels. Really great, hopefully waking you up on this muggy Tuesday afternoon. It is, of course, 3CR's famous Disability Day broadcast, and I'm honoured to be part of it today. I'm guest hosting on Breadline because they needed to get in a disability pensioner to do this for this special day, and I couldn't be more honoured. I am actually having a big day because earlier today, my first ever professional radio documentary went to air on ABC Radio National. It's on the History Listen podcast, if you want to listen to it. Coming up, I'm going to play actually a clip from the documentary. I did an interview. I found out about this gang that used to run North Melbourne. I don't know if you've heard of them. They were called the Crutchy Push. So obviously that piques my attention because I'm disabled. I'm Australian. I've never heard of this kind of, you know, disabled history happening here. It turns out that from 1895 to 1905 in North Melbourne, there was this gang of about 12 to 15 disabled men who just kind of terrorized the neighborhood. They ran things, and all of them used crutches. That was, you know, how they got their name, the Crutchy Push. And the fascinating thing for me is, you know, how did we get to this was a time in the world when the US had the ugly laws, which was making it illegal for disabled people to even be visible in public, basically. And it's now retroactively called the ugly laws because really, you know, this is what so often happens with disability. It was just anyone that the powers that be decides doesn't look right, you know? So it's just like how, you know, if you pathologize behavior that is non-compliant with, you know, whatever the norm is at the time or whatever they need from citizens to keep them compliant, then you can be classified as disabled and you can have your rights taken away. But the thing is that I found from interviewing this historian, this professor of history, Brendan Gleeson, not the actor, sorry, don't get too excited, it's not the Irish actor, but we had a chat about how things disabled people weren't always treated this way by society. So we're just coming to the top of the hour. I'm going to play this interview with a historian and an author, Brendan Gleeson, about the Crutchy Push. And if you want to hear the whole story, you can check it out on the podcast version is on the History Listen through ABC Radio National. But now let's hear from Brendan Gleeson about the Crutchy Push. How are disabled people left out of history?
Well, yes. I mean, that's a big question for other historians as well, of course. In my own investigations, starting with my doctoral thesis in the 90s, was to look into the situation of physically disabled people in 19th century Melbourne and also feudal England. I just did a comparison of the two situations and looking at various records and all that. But it's clear that, I mean, disabled people were in and out of the record in a way, right? So I'll give an instance. When I look back into the feudal era and we think about paintings and famous paintings, Bruegel's very famous painting, The Fight Between Carnival and Lent, which is a sort of a social depiction of what society looked like in the Netherlands in the mid-16th century. Right in the middle of all this sort of representation of villages and all this is a group of disabled, of crippled. We wouldn't comfortably use that term in that way anymore, but that's the way it was used. But they were right in the centre of Bruegel's depiction of what society looked like. And there's a sense in which in the older history, people with disabilities, physical and mental, but particularly physical, were included in the social mindset. But come, you know, the Industrial Revolution and all the changes, 19th century into 20th century, and people with disabilities going into institutions, there's a sense in which they disappeared from social life. And there's all sorts of, you know, explanations and reasons about that. But yeah, and now we live in an era where there's much more recognition and embrace and acceptance. But I do think we certainly went through a long period where people with disabilities were pushed outside the social consciousness.
Yeah, and what happened there? Because in the sort of around the time of the Crutchy Push and its leader Valentine Keating's lifetime, the ugly laws were coming to prominence in the United States. And I was just like, to me, the Crutchy Push represents a really audacious agency for disabled people to be taking in their own lives. And they're sort of existing loudly out in public spaces. They're being visible. They're sort of forcing themselves into people's faces. So what had changed to make, I guess, do you get a sense of how disabled people existed in 19th century Melbourne? Were they visible? Were they, you mentioned being institutionalised, were they sent places like Kew Asylum or cared for in the home?
Yes. I think they were both visible and invisible, if I can put it that way. And that's my investigations in my doctorate, and I published a book called Geographies of Disability after that that sort of summarised all that. But I think certainly lots of people had physical disabilities and they were manifest, right? Because let's think of the Crutchy Push, this small gang of larrikins, and they were never, it seems, more numerous than about 12, 15 or something, but they were set within that almost like a Russian doll of the larger youth push gangs, larrikin gangs that terrorised inner Melbourne, and it was much source of debate. But they appeared, but I think it's a manifestation of the fact that there were people that got around with physical disabilities, particularly in the poorer areas of Melbourne, trying to make do. And there was a lot of push and pull in that. You know, sometimes the police would, because people would drift into vagrancy, because it was very hard to have paid work if you had a physical disability, right, in an industrial city like Melbourne. And that's one of the things that came up in my work. And the police and magistrates, even out of humanity, would sometimes jail people for vagrancy, and they were so-called cripples, again, uncomfortable term, but that's the term that was used, to at least provide some food and lodging for them. When we think back about it all just being so harsh. But anyway, the Crutchy Pushies, were certainly, I think almost globally for the time, significant gang. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary story, that pushed back against that social order and insisted on disorder and their agency. And, you know, I think that's what we're looking at today. I think it's a really interesting story.
And that was a clip from my interview with Professor Brendan Gleeson, historian of disability studies, part of my radio documentary, The Crutchy Push. My name is Caitlin Blythe, and I'm hosting the special Breadline episode today on 3CR for the Disability Day broadcast. And also came out this weekend was the podcast of my first professional radio documentary there, which you just heard a clip from. It's called The Crutchy Push, named after the standover gang of larrikins that used to run North Melbourne at the turn of the 20th century. And they were all one-legged men. They all used crutches to get around and also to sometimes beat people up and try to get free food. They're a really interesting bunch, really charismatic, great stories, great fun. So if you want to listen to the whole story, you can find it on the History Listen podcast, which came out through Radio National. Now I'm going to read you, this is Breadline, presented to you by the Australian Unemployed Workers Union, of which I am a member, and I am also a disability pensioner. And I think, you know, it's just past 5 o'clock here. People are probably getting off work. And sometimes you can feel like, you know, being unemployed or underemployed, there's a pride that comes with employment that you're missing out on. But I don't lack any pride as a disabled pensioner, because my landlord is a welfare recipient. He takes most of my pension. I want to tell you why I feel pride as a welfare recipient, to know that my landlord is also a welfare recipient. He receives most of my pension. In fact, he's 10 times the welfare recipient I am. He receives the pensions of a dozen disabled people. He's hacked the system. He's found a way to receive government pensions without ever having to go through the stress of reading, "You have a new message in your MyGov inbox." I am in awe of him and of all landlords. These beneficent housing providers without whom I would definitely be homeless, and with whom I will only probably be homeless. These are people who already had money and used their money to make more money by taking half of my money. Genius. With such brilliant entrepreneurial minds as these, landlords like my landlord must surely comprehend the advantages of Australia's welfare system. Who benefits more than they? Not I. My landlord owns 30 investment properties. Each one of these properties creates a home for someone and an income for someone else. What a perfect system. Now, my landlord did something that's really smart. He got a government subsidy for those investment properties by renting them out to people on Centrelink. The age pension, the disability support pension, parenting payments, not unemployment payments. Those people could become employed at any moment, and they would make slightly too much money to qualify for social housing, and then where would my landlord be? Looking for a new tenant? He doesn't have the time. What's a more stable income than the disability support pension? If you've got a DSP tenant, you've got someone who is more likely to die than to get off the DSP. And if they don't die, they'll simply age onto the age pension and can keep paying you. It's beautiful. Every fortnight, the same number of dollars lands in a holding account, helpfully administered by me, the tenant, and is then transferred straight into my landlord's pocket. I remember to pay the money, remember to service his mortgage, remind the property manager to do their job, chase up Centrelink when they haven't paid me the landlord's money, take the landlord to VCAT when he's forgotten to keep on top of everything, and I keep the economic wheels turning. They hired the right person for this job. All I needed to overcome my debilitating fatigue and brain fog and executive dysfunction was the monthly threat of homelessness. I'm grateful to them for this opportunity to gain experience working in admin. Work will set you free. The government subsidy that paid private landlords to rent to people on low incomes was scrapped. The National Rental Affordability Scheme. And I was worried for a minute, I won't lie to you. But it's all right. My landlord will be just fine. Private rents have never been higher. Politicians helped out by creating something called rent assistance, a welfare payment that assists landlords to collect more rent. The real estate sector puts rents up, the politicians lobby to raise rent assistance, and everybody wins. The real estate sector makes more money, and the politicians get to look like they care about people on welfare. The rent assistance money passes through my hands on its way to my landlord, and my touch turns it into something good the government is doing for the vulnerable. I'm magic. They make me magic. Australia is a great country for landlords. A third of the population rents privately. My generation generally accepts that we'll never own our own homes. But it's okay, because we get these gigs where we maintain a rich guy's investment property for him. It's like house sitting, except it lasts your whole life. Yes, it can be stressful at times, but all jobs are stressful. And yes, we have to pay a small fee, half our income, to keep this job, but we're allowed to keep the other half of our money to do with as we please. Furnishing the guy's investment property, cleaning the guy's investment property, keeping the guy's investment property warm and dry, and occasionally feeding ourselves to keep our energy up while we look after this guy's investment property. Our supervisor, the property manager, checks in on us regularly to make sure we're doing a good job. The residence needs to continuously look like someone takes care of it while that someone is not actually living there, which is where I, the tenant, come in to do my job. Work is, of course, its own reward, but there is also the reward of not having to sleep rough. Thank you, landlords, housing providers, and also job providers, because they've given me the guaranteed job of looking after their investments for the rest of my natural life. I manage the investment by living in it, taking care of the product home, and also paying its mortgage for my landlord. I love this job so much that every 12 months I am excited to reapply for my position as tenant so I can keep doing it for another year. It's a relief knowing I'll never have to experience the boredom of growing old in one place. I'll never have to face the mundanity of knowing my neighbours or where I'll be living next summer. Will I be able to keep my furniture, or will I move somewhere it won't fit? Will I have to sell it to afford moving costs? The excitement is what keeps me young. It's banal to reach the typical milestones of adulthood. The expectation of having to pack up and move all of my worldly possessions every 6 to 12 months means I keep a minimal lifestyle and never grow too attached to things. Books, childhood mementos, the unconditional love of a pet. What were any of these things doing for me anyway? Every time I'm about to buy something or someone gives me a gift, I think to myself, will this be too heavy to carry to and from the hire car this March? And I hand it back. This lifestyle keeps my diet fresh too, because I can't bulk buy pantry items or save money by storing tinned food. My flat doesn't have a pantry. Storage space is for the rich and the stagnant. I live the jet-setting life on the edge. No need for holidays when I don't know where I'll be sleeping next. Every day is a new adventure. Housing providers fulfill an important role in society. I owe my life to them. I owe everything to them. And now, for some reason, I need to lie down for a while. My name is Caitlin Blythe, and you're listening to Breadline on 3CR. Language warning on this next song.
Life is like a dirty sink in proper. Curry's tin is settling. It's a fucked book. You might make history or catch that hip seat in proper.
When I was new to Melbourne, I found a Food Not Bombs flyer on the road, and I had like this feast with a carrot, and carrots are my favourite vegetable. Yeah, I think they were asking for help doing stuff, and I got in touch.
We, I guess, rescue food
that would otherwise go to waste.
I like the aspect of sharing food and not making anyone feel obligated to pay anything for it.
We make a real point at Food Not Bombs of involving everyone who wants to be involved in whichever part they want to be involved in.
For more information, go to fnbmelb.noblogs.org. Food Not Bombs is a 3CR supporter. Food Not
Bombs. You are listening to Breadline on 3CR 855 AM on your dial or online at 3cr.org.au. My name is Caitlin and I am guest hosting the Breadline show for our special Disability Day broadcast today. All day. It's all disability all day. And pretty soon we're going to be speaking to regular co-host Jessica Harrison, who is phoning in, and we're going to chat about the history of the Disability Support Pension. I'm currently on the Disability Support Pension, and I'm fascinated by the history. And just before the ad break there, we heard Slumlord, that's Slumlord, L-A-W-W-D, with Welcome to Fberg. There's some language on that one, and that's by a band up in Brizzy with frontman Scott Mercer is disabled, and that's just one of my fave songs. Now we're going to speak to Jessica. Hey, Jessica, it's Caitlin.
Yeah, hi.
Hello, good to talk to you. It's been so long.
Yeah, that's right.
We chatted last
night. That's right. Well, thanks for coming on Breadline last night.
Oh, well, thanks for coming on Breadline today.
thanks all round.
So I'd love to chat to you about the history of disability welfare in Australia. What's your experience with the Disability Support Pension?
Well, first of all, my immediate experience is that my neighbour across the road in Wonsaggi applied for it multiple times, and that was a couple of years ago, and we found out that the stat was that only 15% of the people who applied for the DSP actually got it.
Wow.
And, of course, I was aware of her, like, incredible sort of build-up of expectation when she put the application in, and then, of course, the rejection. It was just really demoralising. So, yeah, and, of course, there'll be plenty of people out there listening and in the wider world who have had that experience. So, yeah, we talked on a previous Breadline about some of the dates, you know, that the welfare system, as Nick said in the interview earlier that you had on your show, that, you know, the whole thing about the rights that we have or the benefits are sort of something that working people have fought for in the past. So it's interesting to look at some of the dates. For example, 1920s, 1900 actually, they started talking about introducing pensions. Then in the 1920s, they brought in a national insurance scheme, and that included medical, disability, unemployment pension and pensions for age pensions. So, again, quite, you know, of course, probably again, it was an amazing sort of initiative. And then they had numerous inquiries about that. And then in 1938, they actually abandoned it.
Right.
And then...
Of all times.
I think I said at the time, what the state give us, the state can take away. Then, then of course, the Second World War started, and they did reintroduce it during that time, and that was the widow's pension. They call it child endowment, which was a sort of extra payment if you've got kids. Wife's allowance, I'm not sure what that involved exactly, and unemployment. Now, interestingly, my mum was on the widow's pension because she'd actually divorced my dad, but they were so embarrassed by the concept of a divorcee that was called the widow's pension.
Oh, I see. You just sort of pretend that your husband died.
Yeah, that's right. You couldn't possibly take the initiative to actually leave him for whatever reason. Yeah, so that was the widow's pension that we received when I was, a kid. And, of course, it really helped us survive. In fact, the other thing they had for the widow's pension was they had a six-month period where you had to survive basically on nothing to prove that you weren't being kept by a man secretly.
Oh my gosh.
So I remember that. I remember that period, of course. I mean, we lived in the bush, so I don't remember incredible amounts of economic problems because I was a kid, but no doubt my mum and my grandma would have been sort of quite, having to be very frugal at that time. Yes, a 6-month period. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I think a lot of people, I mean, I had the assumption that a lot of Australia's welfare state sort of came into being after World War II. But actually, there was an economic depression in the 1890s and in the colonies. And there was a royal commission in 1906, and it actually led to the invalid pension and the age pension being introduced in 1908 on the recommendations of this royal commission.
Right, interesting, yeah.
So much earlier than I thought this kind of thing would have been happening. But it's fascinating because I've read through a bunch of historical archives and found some absolutely, obviously terrible quotes from the white colonizing men in charge at the time about, you know, what to do with the disabled people. And I think the invalid pension had a clause where you had to be, you know, the right kind of character. And you weren't allowed to be a woman who had, you know, run out on her family is the way they put it. So,
interesting. Yeah,
from the beginning.
Deserving poor and the undeserving poor, basically.
Well, of course, it was coming out of the Victorian era. So, I mean, that was like, you know, Victorian era, obviously not the state, but like, imported from England's Queen Victoria's reign. Just like so many concerns about the morality of charity and, you know, the deserving poor and women's place in the home and, the real separation of some people still allowed to exist in public, but really most of these people, you know, women, disabled people, children, locked away into the private sphere, as they called it.
Yeah.
So,
and
I still see it today. I mean, I feel like people like Scott Morrison and, now Dutton really want to revive the morality politics of the Victorian era. They love it.
The good old days, they would regard that. Yeah.
It probably was the good old days for people like them, which is horrible.
I suppose, coming up to the present, I mean, the thing I still get shocked by is the sort of privileged people who don't realise that there isn't any kind of benefit now if you are sick and just unable to work, you know, having previously had a job. People assume there's some kind of safety net there. And as we know, there are people going around. Well, the example I use is someone in Wonthaggi who came to one of our early meetings who had to bring her oxygen tank with her to the job centre, and then she was getting sent for job. And, you know, I just can't believe that was not, you know, that was the case. But that's really what we're fighting against.
Yeah.
A whole lot of sick people who are not able to work but are still forced through this ridiculous rigmarole of, the job centres
There's been a real ramping up in the last couple of decades of the rhetoric around disabled people needing to work, that get them back to work. Mm-hmm. And of course, like, all the targeting of people on unemployment payments, you know, necessarily affects disabled people because so many disabled people are on, you know, Newstart, JobSeeker as like a kind of de facto disability payment, even though it's obviously way under what you can live on. As is the DSP. I mean, I saw an article recently. I wish I could remember where I read it, but it sort of said something that I've been saying for years, just off my own experiences, which is that there's like a minimum wage, but then there's like there's like the poverty line, but then there's like a higher poverty line for disabled people because your living expenses are higher as a result of your disabilities. You know, the DSP obviously isn't livable.
Yeah. And then, of course, we've got the rental crisis thrown in, which is that that there are people who just have to spend, almost all of their pension on rent to just have a roof over their heads. And
No, it's to me, if we're going to talk about morality, that's what's immoral. But also, I think the really interesting thing is we can see how ideological it has been from the start, because as in the start of Australia's welfare state, because it's always about the character of the colony. There's always been a concern about, you know, the morality of the colony, and, like, you know, if we give poor, you know, eugenics obviously came to was rising in the 20th century. We're still seeing it rise, you know, as the COVID pandemic continues. But there's a real sense of, like, do we want to even, maybe we should just let disabled and chronically ill people die off? Like, you know, do we want women of, you know, loose morals to have any support, or, you know, that sort of thing? So obviously the welfare state is very much, you know, the welfare system is very much bound up in the sort of, you know, the state's idea of itself. Like, what kind of state are we going to be?
We're meant to be eternally grateful for the payments that stop us from having to eat from the supermarket bins.
And, like, we're supposed to perform gratitude all the time. If anyone, like, throws us a bone, it's days like that. Like today on 3CR, the Disability Day broadcast, are great because it's just such a balm to hear so many disabled people speaking and dissenting, and honestly sometimes just being angry or having a laugh and existing for ourselves, like, and not just as objects for non-disabled people to consume. It's great.
Taking the front foot and taking we're not objects.
We're whole people. Imagine.
I've got in front of me as well, we were going to talk a bit about, like, the DSP and getting onto the DSP.
Yeah.
I've got a bit of stuff on that if you'd like that at this stage.
I would love that. It's been over a decade since I got on the DSP, and I know that the rules have changed several times since then. So
my
advice is all out of date, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, I suppose the exciting thing is there are some great organisations to support new applications, and one is the Disability Resources Centre, and they've got a really hot, up-to-date website that I'm looking at right now. And then there's also the people you played there a card for them earlier, that's Social Security Rights Victoria.
Yes.
And they've also, so there's two great websites, and if people are listening and can't write those down at the moment or get them, it's pretty good. You know, drc.org.au is the Disability Resources Centre, and the other one, Social Security Rights Victoria, dsphelp.org.au.
dsphelp.org.au, that's great.
Yeah.
And, the union that we're both a part of that's presenting this show, Australian Unemployed Workers Union, also offers support to people who are...
We've got a page on our website and... which links actually to both of those, so don't have to write those down quickly. But I think what's even better that we have is our advocacy line. So that's run by AUW members like Daryl, who's on Breadline's show. And it's, so you're really talking peer-to-peer, not talking to someone who's sort of in an office, but sort of paid or... or volunteer, you know, it's actually by other people who've gone through what you've gone through. So, the number there, which you can easily find, auw.org.au, but it's an 1-800 number, 1-800-289-848.
So that's 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Monday to Friday, the phone line is available.
Yes. That's right.
And you can speak to a volunteer who will help you. And as Jessica was saying, you know, they're not someone who's a mandatory reporter or is that what the phrase is? But, like, they're not someone who works for the state, basically.
Yeah, exactly. It's another person just like you. And you know, I'm totally in awe of the people who sort of volunteer their time on that, and also the people who coordinate the rosters, because it's just pretty important. Another thing about the applications for the DSP that people have a lot of trouble with is the medical evidence, because when you're applying, you've got to just be so careful to have ticked all the boxes. And so what they've got on the Disability Resources Centre website is a medical evidence bot. So in other words, and they can help you sort of write up the letter in a way that you know, it's what they want, you know, it sort of ticks all their their preconceived ideas of what you should have in a letter. So
yeah,
that's one thing. And I suppose other people I know who've got on it have said it really helps to have a friend, or sometimes you can get hold of a Centrelink social worker who might help with the process. But yeah, having the support of these organisations, I think, really does make a difference. And then, of course, people do have to do sometimes multiple applications, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, I think that's the case, yeah. So, I mean, I guess don't be, I mean, can't tell you how to feel about it, but, like, don't be too disheartened, I suppose, if your first application is rejected. Obviously, it's not good, it's going to suck, but, I mean, know that it's, you know, it's not the end of the road, hopefully.
Yeah, that's right. And also, that's the other great thing about being able to ring up the union or ring up one of these other organisations and just have a big complaint about it. That someone else listening. That's what I'd recommend anyway.
Oh, can never underestimate the cathartic power of complaining to someone who's also going through the same thing. It's great.
Yeah, that's right.
But, I mean, I can say from my experience, I was on, speaking of, you know, you and I were talking earlier, Jessica, about how there is no longer a sickness payment. I was on New Start incapacitated for a couple of years, which is New Start, but they don't make you do mutual obligations. I think that's what
it
was.
Yes.
I still remember doing mutual obligations, though, so I'm not sure what happened there. But anyway, that doesn't exist anymore, so which it was like a really good bridging time for me because I was too sick to work. And obviously too sick to look for work, but also like hadn't got onto the DSP yet.
Well, these days, yeah, people have to get a medical certificate that covers them for 3 months to be able to just avoid those mutual obligations. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, the other thing we're encouraging people to do is try and go for the online service, which means that you don't necessarily have to then get yourself into an interview.
Yeah. Look, we're coming up on the end of the show, Jessica, but it's been so great talking to you.
Good.
And thank you to everyone for listening to the Disability Day special. This has been Breadline. My name's been Caitlin. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Bye.